Samson Abramsky is a computer scientist of the very best kind. he's made important contributions in game semantics, domain theory, the lazy lambda calculus, and much more. In recent years, he's turned his attention to quantum foundations. So he and Bob Kirker initiated the very successful category theoretic approach to quantum theory. And more recently, he's been looking at unifying sort of Bell's theorem and contextualized groups under the same framework. He's a fellow of the Royal Society, which is in London. He's also a fellow of the Royal Society of Edinburgh, which is in Edinburgh, but he's not yet a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada. So today he's going to speak on information flow, tracing a path through logic, computation, topology, and physics.
Okay, thank you very much, Lucien. I'm tempted to ask what a computer scientist of the worst kind is, but I don't think I will. It's a great pleasure to be here again. I'm tempted to say, my, how you've grown, because the place is twice as big as it was the last time I was here. And it's a great honor to have the opportunity to speak in this colloquium. So I am a computer scientist. Interested nowadays in, as Lucien was saying, in quantum information and quantum foundations. What I'd like to do is to address some general issues, some computer science perspectives on information and how this relates to also to some ideas from the physics side of things. My view is, I sort of have an optimistic view that there's currently a very fruitful and active interaction across the boundaries of these disciplines, which I think is a very good thing and certainly something I've enjoyed being involved in. And so I'd like to address some of these common concerns. So the theme I want to take is a large one. Of course, I'll only be able to say a little bit about it, but it's nothing less than information, which is a word that's everywhere and something that is everywhere in our everyday lives. It's actually a depressing thought if you think about, in a way, if you think about the common, what a working day is nowadays and how much of it consists in reading one's emails, digesting and sort of coming back and throwing some emails back at the rest of the world. So to a large extent, what we're doing is information processing. Our cultural lives, to a large extent, is about information. We live in an information age, but what information is and what its fundamental nature and structure is still in many ways rather elusive. In fact, there are also, of course, skeptics about information who don't really think that it's a fundamental thing. And I think that's certainly a point of view worth taking seriously. My view is that it is does have intrinsic structure and a kind of objective content. But in some ways, that has to be shown still. A point to make is that a lot of disciplines have things to say, non-trivial things to say, about information from their own perspectives. And these things don't necessarily fit well together, or we don't currently understand how to fit them well together. Of course, physics has a lot to say about information, but biology is very much concerned with information. And then we have mathematics, logic, computer science, statistics, game theory, linguistics, and many more areas, in fact. And the parable of the blind man and the elephant, so each sort of feels their own part of the elephant and comes to a conclusion about what the elephant is, and they're all different, certainly comes to mind in thinking of all these multiple views of information. So the sort of question, the sort of aspiration is, could there be some comprehensive unified theory of information? Now again, a skeptic might say, well, there was this great man, Shannon, who founded the mathematical theory of information, and well, we've had to sort of modify it for quantum information theory and so on, but surely that has the sort of ownership rights on information, and that's kind of the end of the story. These things are very important, but I don't think that is the end of the story. And I'd like to illustrate this with an anecdote, which perhaps also shows how it's possible to sort of be at cross purposes when we talk across disciplines about these different aspects of information. So I was actually giving a talk to a general audience, something over 10 years ago, about sort of informatics, which was just starting at Edinburgh at that time, and a sort of broad program of studying information. And I was talking quite happily, as computer scientists often do, about how information increases in computation. Let me put this in the form of a puzzle. I mean, we know from the sort of many people's great work a lot about how we compute, but let me ask this very naive question: why do we compute? Why do we actually perform computations? And there's an obvious answer, and that was the answer I'd been taking for granted in my talk, which is that we compute in order to gain information that we didn't previously have. Now, there was a distinguished physicist in the audience, now actually knighted, who stood up at the end and sort of said, well, I don't know much about computer science, but I know some information theory. How can you speak of information increase? Information theory tells us you can only lose information, you can't gain it, which nonplussed me at the time. Now, of course, there's no real paradox here, but I mean, it's interesting that actually a very distinguished physicist, I won't say who it was, I'll, so to speak, cast a cloak of invisibility over his name, sort of he was puzzled about this, and yet, sort of two disciplines speaking at cross purposes. Now, of course, it's no more paradoxical that we compute in order to gain information than it is that we turn on our heating to make ourselves warmer without sort of violating anything, because, of course, we're taking energy from the environment, or we're taking information from the environment. So there is a moral here of this little story, that this information gain, which is certainly involved in why we compute, is relative to a subsystem. So information is about subsystems or agents, as we might call them, Alice and Bob, familiar from quantum information and so on. And the dynamics of computation, I mean, the reason we perform computation, what it's about and how we have to understand it, is exactly about information flow to and from these subsystems or agents. So actually, understanding what's going on with information is very much about this idea of information flow. Yes?
Do you really not think that in his lifetime Shakespeare was able to increase the information in the world?
Of course he did, yes. But did he do that absolutely? Or, I mean, did he violate the second law of thermodynamics? Presumably not. Did he?
It's not clear the second law is relevant to the
system. Well, sure. So, we might think that with computing, we were with some more. With Shakespeare, we're talking about culture and so on. So the notion of information might not be, might not be so clear that what he was adding was information in the same literal sense. Anyway, I mean, I'm on the side of saying that we do increase information. It was the physicist who was kind of beating on me that, how could I speak of that? But with computing, I think there's a more obvious question in these terms than there is with something like a cultural contribution. But it is a puzzle. In a sense, it is a puzzle, and we don't have that good an answer to it, it seems to me. I mean, of course, there's a wider notion that with evolution and biology, we seem to get systems of increasing complexity, and how is that happening consistently with thermodynamics? So we can see Shakespeare at the top end of that. But even in this humble realm of computation, where everything seems to be precise, there is this little puzzle here that I wanted to draw attention to, which incidentally is closely linked to long-standing puzzles in logic, for example. Leaving aside this kind of physical thing, that we draw conclusions in logic, but of their nature, the information in the conclusions was contained in our assumptions. I mean, that's what logical inference means. So there's a question about what's actually going on when we perform deduction. Okay, so I just wanted to tell this little tale just to show that we don't have a common and clear understanding even of some very basic points here. And coming back to this idea that why computer scientists do routinely speak about information increase, let me just show you, I think it may be informative just to see the way that computer scientists often think about computation, a very simple natural model of information increasing computation. And this relates to recursive definitions, which are fundamental in programming, but also in logic, foundations of mathematics, and so on. And I'll illustrate it with a sort of stupid example, but nevertheless a standard one for this purpose, and just to have something easy to explain. The factorial function, so just the product of the first n numbers, and where we take factorial of 0 to be 1. And usually we just write it down as a product with some ellipses in there, but computers aren't very good at figuring out ellipses, so if we want to write down a program, we'd better write some kind of recursive definition like this. So this is a recursive definition. It refers to itself. What does it mean? How do we give meaning in general to these kinds of recursive definitions? Well, the thing that's emerged in computer science, not recently, a long time ago, is that we can understand in a uniform way recursive definitions as fixed points. And that eliminates, in a sense, the self-reference. So we can take the factorial function here to be the fixed point of a certain functional, something that acts on functions of partial functions of natural numbers. And the way that this works, the way that we obtain this fixed point constructively, because after all, in the end, the computer has to actually go away and figure this out just from the recursive definition, very clearly gives us a picture of information increase. So we're dealing with partial functions, as I said, so we have a natural zeroth approximation where we have no information about the values of this function. So our zeroth approximation just says we don't know any ordered pair that's in the function. Now, our first approximation, starting off from this point here of zero information, is to say, okay, well, I can exercise this recursive definition. And fortunately, that if n equals zero case gives me some definite and immediate information that doesn't refer to any information about factorial that I'm already assumed to have. So directly, without even though we started from a zero information point, we can at least achieve this one value that the factorial function has. And that enters into our first approximation. So you see, we've increased our information. We've added an ordered pair. There's a little process of information increase going on here. Well, now we can do the same thing again, but now using what's previously been obtained as a base for using the definition. And now when we use the definition, if we happen to take the value 1, then when we look at the recursive call, we can refer to our previous approximation. And since the recursive call is to factorial of 0, we have an answer to that. And that lets us answer the question what factorial of 1 is. So this is not very impressive, but nevertheless, you see that we're sort of gradually getting the values of the factorial in a well-grounded way by a process of information increase. The kth approximation gives us the first k values, and the limit of this increasing sequence of approximations gives us the whole thing, which is, in fact, the least fixed point of the associated functional. So that's the sort of reason that this is the mathematics that underlies recursive definitions why computer scientists routinely talk about information increase. Now, that wasn't very impressive because the factorial is a simple thing. So let's just take a quick look at something more surprising where the very same notion can still apply. And this takes us into rather deeper waters about where reflexivity and self-reference appear in a less obvious form. So in particular, I want to look at a classic of the theory of computation to illustrate this, namely Church's lambda calculus. So one speaks of the Church-Turing thesis. This was one of the original foundational formalisms to express what was the notion of a computable function. And this is an incredibly sparse formal calculus which is computationally universal. Everything that's computable can be expressed in this calculus. But it's also a kind of completely unrestrained calculus for the expression of functions, where in this pure form, we don't sort of say it's functions from natural numbers or from reals. It could be anything. So we have expressions just built up either from variables, from a notion of application. So we have any two expressions, and we can apply one to the other. And then there's this idea of abstraction. We make a function of x, where if you give me a value for x, I then compute the body t. So you can think of this like a way of forming a subroutine. We take a parameter x, and for any value we're given for that, we compute a value as specified by the expression t. And the dynamics of this is exactly what you might expect if you've ever written a subroutine. Here's my subroutine, and here's an actual argument when I call the subroutine. So I simply replace the formal parameter x by the argument u. I substitute it in the body and carry on in that fashion. So this is a very simple-looking dynamics, but this is incredibly rich, as it turns out. Everything that's computable can be expressed just in these terms. We haven't given ourselves integers or anything else to compute with, but none of that is needed. Integers and every other data structure you can think of can be represented in this calculus. And many quite alarming-looking things can be represented in this calculus. For example, self-application, because any expression can be applied to any expression. So, for example, x can be applied to x. This takes us well beyond sort of usual mathematical experience, although, of course, it's the kind of thing that turns up in foundations of mathematics and also in recursion theory and so on. So we can form terms that have, in some obvious way, bad behavior. If I apply the self-application term to itself and use this dynamics, you see that it simply gets stuck in a loop and rewrites to itself. So that's not a very useful term. But this rather gruesome-looking term, the Y combinator, has a rather magical property. This actually encapsulates the idea of recursion that we were just looking at. It has the rather amazing property that if you apply it to any term and then apply this dynamics of reduction, you end up with the term applied to this thing y of t. In other words, it's built a fixed point for an arbitrary term. Now again, this goes well outside ordinary mathematical experience. Usually we expect that only in very special circumstances do we have fixed points of functions. But here in this calculus, any term whatsoever has a fixed point, and moreover we can produce it just from this simple-looking dynamics. So it's a formal calculus, it's a rather remarkable one, but how on earth could we understand it? Incidentally, this is all closely related to issues in the foundations of mathematics. And in fact, Curry originally extracted the Y combinator from an analysis of Russell's paradox. This self-application is very close to self-reference. Another thing that we'll notice later is in this self-application, in particular, there's the sort of humble but nevertheless essential-looking point that we have two copies of x here. We're able to make copies of arguments, as we normally expect to do if we write a functional expression. Okay, well, this might just seem to be a logician's fantasy or nightmare, but it's actually, it was the foundation of the Lisp language, arguably the first high-level functional programming language, and still with us, and of many current languages, including things like Microsoft C#, a lot of the ideas in current versions of Java, as well, of course, as the functional languages that are nowadays quite widely used. And as we've said, it has universal expressive power. Now, the point I want to make about this is simply that using the same simple idea about information increase that we were discussing earlier, we can and just having this idea of finite pieces of information about something, just as we saw with the factorial, but now just about functional behavior of an expression, we can actually make in quite a simple way a mathematical model of this idea. It took several decades till this was understood, it was developed in the context of a theory known as domain theory, pioneered by Damon Scott. So what is a finite piece of information about how a function may behave? So we'll take a finite piece of information to be a pair where the first component is a finite set of these finite pieces of information, and the second component is itself just a finite piece of information. Now, of course, this is itself an inductive definition. It doesn't look very well founded, but if we start off with some set of atoms, basic pieces of information, then you can build up step by step in much the same way as we saw with the factorial function. We can build up in a well-defined way these finite pieces of information. I start off with some atoms, now I form a, if I've already got a set of finite pieces, I can form a pair consisting of a finite set of the things I've already got, and then one of the things I've already got, and so on. The reading of one of these things is that if a function satisfies or contains this finite piece of information, then what that's saying is exactly that whenever it's applied to an argument which satisfies all the finite pieces of information in S, it produces a result which itself satisfies or contains the information A. So it's, in a coherent way, it's giving us a finite piece of information about functional behavior. And the idea is that the meaning of a term will then be collectively described not by one of these, but by the set of all the finite pieces of information that it contains. And because we can have a whole set of an infinite set of these things, we can have finite levels of being applied to things and producing results and so on. And hence we can give a consistent meaning to these ideas like self-application and so on. And just to give the essential point here, this is how we, if we think about this collection of finite pieces of information, we can think of this in some sense as giving us the potential behavior of something used as a function. It tells us what it would do if applied to some argument. So the way we use this is in defining what the meaning of an application is. So the idea with this kind of semantics is that we inductively associate to each expression, following the way it's built up syntactically, all the finite pieces of information that it satisfies. So to say what an application is, bearing in mind that we have to cover these cases such as self-application, and we say this will contain any finite piece of information A, such that the function part contains a finite piece of information which is one of these pairs, where S is supposed to be a description of some finite part of the information in the argument. So provided the argument satisfies all of the pieces of information in S, and provided the function, whenever it's given something which satisfies S produces A, then the result of the application will produce A. In some sense, this is reducing the, we can read it in a logical way as unpacking the information. Okay, so this is what I wanted to say about this way of using these ideas about pieces of information and information increase. And this simple construction, in fact, does give a consistent model of the lambda calculus, which gives a proper account of all these rather remarkable-looking phenomena of self-application, fixed points, and so on. Okay, now at this point, or maybe probably already some while ago, you may have been asking yourself, where is physics in all of this? So one interesting point that we can make is that this kind of recursive and reflexive behavior, we could say, is emergent in some sense. It's certainly been argued that recursive phenomena, self-reference and so on, play a fundamental role in biology and at higher levels, perhaps in some of the in contributions such as those of Shakespeare, in cognition, language, reasoning, agent interactions, and so on. And so what we could ask, and I don't have an answer to this, but we could ask at which physical level do they arise? And one of the reasons that there are some subtleties here is that, as we sort of saw in passing, recursion involves the ability to copy or to clone things. So if we recall this definition of the fixed-point combinator, it's a way of providing self-replication. And the fact that an argument can be used multiple times plays an essential role in that. If we just recall the dynamics of the recursion combinator for a moment, it's really taking this argument and making fresh copies of it. That's the essential trick in doing this recursion. So, on the other hand, we can ask, how does this emerge from the quantum level where we don't have the ability to copy? Of course, you can say this is a special case of the question, how does the classical world in general emerge from the quantum level? But perhaps this is a particularly sharp form of it. And it may also be worth saying that this idea of copying is deeply implicated in the blow-up of computational complexity that we have in the classical theory of computation. If we take away the ability to copy data, we take away the ability to have exponential blow-ups in complexity. Now, another way of phrasing this is to ask, how does non-linearity arise from linearity? And what I have in mind here is a kind of logical non-linearity, this idea that if we can make copies of arguments, that in some sense we're not using resources in a realistic fashion. Okay, so these are some themes of which are sort of dear to computer scientists in classical computation. But having made this point, what I'd now like to do is to turn back to linear forms of information flow, where I think we do get an interesting connection between what happens in computer science and what happens in physics, and in particular in quantum information. So I now want to turn, having had a glance at some of these classical topics in computation, I now like to turn to linear forms of information flow. And these arise at the quantum level, and they play a key role in quantum information. But we can also recognize linear versions of information flow, of the same kinds of things we were just looking at here, but now suitably linearized, not without this feature of being able to copy at will. We can recognize these in logic, in computation, and even in linguistics and so on. And so because of this commonality, this common thread that we can find here, I think this does provide at least some steps towards a unified theory in answer to the question we were raising when we began, how do we account for all these different manifestations of information? Okay, so let's come back to something which I guess in this audience is much more familiar comfortable. So let's think of quantum entanglement. We have highly correlated entangled states, the Bell state or the EPR state. And as we know, we can represent compound systems by the tensor product. And we get phenomena such as Bell's theorem showing the non-locality, the essential non-locality of quantum mechanics. In fact, the essential non-locality of any theory which produces the empirical predictions of quantum mechanics. So how does that play in terms of the kinds of things we've been talking about? Notice that this is, when we're talking here about compound systems and tensor products, we're exactly talking about subsystems, agents, information flow between agents. So we're coming back to those issues, but now on the quantum realm, and as we say, in this kind of linearized setting. So let's take a classic example in this field, the teleportation protocol. So here we make use of this entanglement in order to achieve an interesting effect, something that goes beyond what can be achieved in classical computation. So we were saying earlier that in a sense when we go to the quantum realm, we give up the ability to clone and therefore the ability to have some of the, apparently the ability to have some of these recursive and reflexive features, which are common features of classical computation. But of course, we also gain certain things as well. And here we look at one of the famous examples of the kind of thing that can be achieved using quantum entanglement. So most people, this would be very familiar, but let me recall that the scenario here is that we have Alice and Bob, our two agents or subsystems, maybe spatially separated. Space-like separated. We prepare this entangled qubit, which they share as a resource, and they use this in some sense as a channel to achieve a certain, or a shared resource to achieve an information flow, say, from Alice to Bob. So Alice inputs an unknown qubit, performs certain measurements, makes a classical communication to Bob, and then possibly with some unitary correction, Bob will end up possessing exactly the same state of a qubit that the unknown qubit that Alice originally had. And of course, Alice is performing a purely local operation. Bob is performing a purely local operation. The only overt communication that happens between them is a classical communication, which if we're transmitting a qubit, just involves two classical bits. And yet, with this, we're able to achieve a perfect replication of a qubit transmitted from Alice to Bob. And the mathematical point, the sort of essential structural point we'd like to focus on here is a certain view that's proved to be very fruitful in this work on categorical quantum mechanics, for example, that Lucien was mentioning. And of course, in various forms, plays an important role in many aspects in quantum information. So, and this is the idea that the way we have to understand entangled, or one of the best ways of understanding entangled states, one of the best ways of understanding this sort of highly correlated information in compound systems, which is precisely useful for understanding information flows between the different parts of the system, is in terms of this map state duality. The fact that a state living in a tensor product can be thought of as a linear map. In fact, we have a certain freedom either to think of it as a linear map going from the first factor to the second or vice versa. And of course, a linear map between the factors can be thought of as a channel or something achieving an information flow from one part of the system to the other. So that piece of structure gives us a very important handle on understanding how information flows work in an entangled system of this kind. Okay, so map state duality, vectors or states living on the tensor product are biuniquely associated with linear maps from one factor to the other. And we'll use this little bit of notation here. If I'm given a linear map, so it's going, say, from one factor to the other, we'll write this for the projector, P sub F for the projector on the tensor product, H tensor H. So the projector onto the ray determined by the vector, which is associated with the map F under map state duality. Okay, so we have two steps here. We have the idea that if I give you a state in any Hilbert space, it determines a ray, and there's a projector onto that ray. But also, in particular, the place our rays come from are vectors in this tensor product, and under map state duality, those vectors are associated with maps. Hence, we get projectors corresponding to maps. This might remind you of the lambda calculus a little bit, and in fact, it should, because there's something similar going on here, and ultimately, understanding how to work smoothly with this does involve, essentially, some of the same ideas, albeit in a linearized form. Okay, so since we have many experts here, and you're all very familiar with doing calculations here, it's perhaps interesting to consider this little scenario. Well, we arrange ourselves a little network of projectors on this threefold tensor product of Hilbert spaces, maybe just qubit spaces, say. And what we see here are projectors determined by certain linear maps in the way that we've just explained. So this little network is just described by this composition of projectors. And the question we want to ask is, how can we describe the behavior as we go through this little network? And in particular, we're interested in understanding if we put in a particular state on this input, what we will get as appearing on the rightmost output. And the right way of thinking about this is somehow not to take a bunch of numbers, numerical representations of the vectors and matrices involved, and to crunch them, but rather to understand this in a structural way and to see the information flow that is happening here. In fact, here is the right answer. And you see that although here what we have are projectors on these tensor product states, what we have in this expression here is where we define the information flow directly by this composition of maps, this composition of linear maps. So we really are using the maps in this map state duality to tell us exactly what the information flow through the system is. So in that sense, it's a very elegant and direct answer. On the other hand, it may look a bit like a crazy answer, because you see that we're, you know, if we think of information physically flowing upwards in time, we see the first box we see here is F1, but the first thing we see in this expression here is F2, and then we see F1 after that, then we see F3, or rather it's adjoint, then we see F2 again, but now it's adjoint, then we see F4, which is the last box there, and then we see F3. So the order in which we encounter these maps bears no relation to the physical flow of information through the network, right? So I'm telling you this is the right answer, but the question is, why is this the right answer? And the way to answer that, as I say, is not to crunch through a numerical example, but rather to make this kind of diagram. Because now we can read this expression off just by following the path that we follow through this network. And this path, you see, is built up out of these sort of rather squarish cups and caps that snake their way through this array of boxes. And literally by following the path, we read off this expression. So the line tells us what the information flow is, but what does the line mean? And this falls out from the properties we get using the map state duality, using this, which can be written in this form, this correspondence between linear maps or the HOM and the tensor product, and then a decomposition of these projectors. Now, traditionally in foundations of quantum mechanics, projectors are taken as basic building blocks of the theory, but we're going to sort of open up this black box, in particular with interest of the fact that these are all projectors on tensor product spaces. And in fact, we're using map state duality, and where we have the so where we have a left to right flow, the map was, F was supposed to be from the first factor to the second, then under map state duality, the corresponding vector is going to be the lower part of the projector here, if you think of the sort of Ketbrar description of the projector. And similarly, if we happen to be going in the other direction, we use the adjoint. So we go back from the second factor to the first. So this gives us a way of seeing the information, opening up the boxes and seeing the information flow through these projectors. And then the key step in obtaining this description of the path, if you look at this, you see that there's the top half of the projector and the bottom half, the Ketbrar, as it were. And indeed, you see that we never go through one of these boxes. We either go through in one direction or the other, a bottom half or a top half of the box. And it becomes evident why that is when you look at this description of the projector, which is just the Ketbrar. Ah, a question.
The previous slide.
We didn't care about them.
We have two inputs and two outputs, which are not figured in that.
Yes. But yes. Well, we could put in identities there or something. We're just focusing on that particular one. So we can write a functional expression that takes care of all the inputs and the outputs. Once we've opened up these projectors, then we see that the way we get the path is exactly by connecting up these pieces that we had there. And the fact that we get a correct description of the information flow through the system just by combining these pieces in this line follows from the fact that if I have a top half of a projector here described where the information flow is described by some linear map G, and the bottom half of another projector here where the information flow is described by a linear map F under map state duality, as we see here, then I can, so to speak, pull the line and simplify the whole expression to get this composition of maps. And that gives a correct description of the information flow through the system. Now, that is something that follows from the sort of structure one gets around map state duality. I mean, in categorical terms, the fact that one has a compact closed category. Once we have that component, once we have this basic law, as it were, then we can get that expression for the information flow automatically. How do we get it? We get it from a more basic identity, which looks like this. Once I've opened up the box, my expression looks like this. Now, it doesn't matter now, once I've expressed this in terms of these compositions, if I topologically deform this to pull this G up and this F down. And if I do that, what I'm left with in the middle is this kind of kink in the line. So it's just the identity, there's nothing going on, but it's just been, it's the identity represented on the tensor product. And if you think about what happens to the identity map on the tensor product under map state duality, it is in fact exactly the Bell state. So we have a Bell state and a co-Bell state, if you like, and the basic identity that we need is that when we combine them in this fashion, they just cancel out into a straight line. So we just pull the line out and we get this composition. And the bit of magic that we have here is that in our original expression, physically, the box with the G in it is happening first, and the box with the F in it is happening afterwards. But after we do this topological deformation, it's the F that we see first and then the G. So there's a sort of inversion of order here. That's part of the description of what's going on. And from this, we immediately get this description of teleportation. Here's our Bell basis, where the one of the projectors, the ICE projector, in the measurement that Alice performs is described, or the bottom half is described by one of these boxes. Here's a Bell state that we've prepared, which is this channel between Alice and Bob. And we can now see, in fact, what Bob's correction, unitary correction, has to be in order to achieve the correct working of teleportation. Alice, essentially, by classical communication, has to say which of these projectors, which of these branches of the measurement was observed to happen. And Bob then has to choose the unitary correction, which is exactly the inverse of that map. And the net information flow, by what we just said, is going to be the composition of these two maps. And we see that the correction works correctly. And we get the original qubit transmitted from Alice to Bob. So this is a sort of starting point for general use of these kind of structures. Is a more technical point of view, using monoidal categories and structures in monoidal categories, things like compact structure, Frobenius algebras, and so on, which has been developed quite extensively, both in the quantum group in Oxford, in the computer science department, with my colleague Bob Cooker and myself, and by others as well. There's this diagrammatic representation, as we've seen. And there are a lot of connections with logic and category theory, but the diagrammatic representation makes this very appealing and attractive. And we're now building up some quite sophisticated tool support. There's a tool called Quantumatic that's been developed for a couple of years that really lets you plug and play with these diagrams and incorporates tactics and quite sophisticated graph rewriting and so on. And there's been a lot of ongoing applications, formalization of quantum protocols, key distribution, lots of other things, and also foundational topics as well. Okay, how much time do I have left?
10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay. So we started off with some classical computation. We looked at a linearized version, and we see that it's actually sitting right there in quantum information, the quantum foundations. So now I want to show that the same kind of structures that we've just observed here in the quantum setting actually are very pervasive in a lot of other areas as well, as kind of linear versions of structures that we find in logic, in computation, and even in things like linguistics as well. So the motto is, so when I talk about string diagrams, I'm not talking about string theory here, but these kind of diagrams with sort of wires snaking around and sort of diagrammatic manipulation, where we see in a very visual way how the information flows are through the system and the kind of simplifications that goes with that. So we've just seen that it turns up in quantum information, and it turns up in these other things as well. And so in the time remaining, I just want to trace a path through these, at least to show you some pictures and show to what remarkable extent the same kind of diagrams turn up in quite a remarkable variety of contexts. So let me begin with something very simple but rather beautiful that comes up in knot theory and topology, the Temperley-Leib algebra, which plays a central role in the Jones polynomial and related developments. And the nicest way of presenting the Temperley-Leib algebra due to Lou Kaufman is diagrammatically. And when we present it that way, we immediately see that we're dealing with the same kind of structure we were just discussing in the quantum. So with n in dimension n, size n, we connect up n dots to n dots in a planar fashion, where we can connect things up either on the same side, top to top or bottom to bottom, where we get cups or caps respectively, or we can connect up a dot in the top row to a dot in the bottom row. And in particular, we have these generators, where in each possible position we have a facing cup and cap, and otherwise we just connect up top to bottom. And these are the relations. Now, the idea is you multiply these diagrams by stacking them up one on top of the other and then just chasing through the path. So you see, it's exactly the same idea of following the path through and straightening it out where appropriate. So here is the first generator, U1, stacked up on top of a copy of the second generator, U2, and then stacked up on top of another copy of U1 again. And we see we can simplify here. The same kind of simplification we were just doing before in the quantum situation, and we get this equation that it comes back to U1. Of course, how long things are is irrelevant here. It's up to isotropy. And we can also form loops, as we see if we multiply one of the generators with itself. So a loop is thought of as a scalar that can float around and will ultimately generate the not polynomial. So we think of this as something sitting in the center of this little monoid, or more generally, or then we make it into an algebra. And finally, if things are not near to each other, they just pass each other by. They just commute in this evident fashion. So these are the generators of the Temperley-Lieb monoid, the multiplicative part of the algebra. And we get a category of the very same kind that we were sort of implicitly looking at with Hilbert spaces in the quantum information situation. And in particular, so we just saw how these multiplications can look. So the general case is that we may sort of have some long path through a diagram until we either come out the same side or the other side. And the basic cases are these laws. And these laws, with cancelling out cups and caps with each other, you may recognize are the very same thing we used in the key step in here, in showing the information flow in teleportation. It's the same structure. That's the point. Okay, so and this is, in fact, the sort of basic axiom of compact closed structure. Oh, and here is, in fact, my little diagram for teleportation to remind us that it's the same thing going on. In fact, although this looks like a limited repertoire of generators, it's sufficiently rich to express all planar ways of joining up dots in the fashion that we've indicated. So, for example, we can join up the leftmost to the rightmost, where the other things just get made into cups and caps by this combination of generators here. And we have a diagrammatic notion of trace, where we use cups and caps to close off the dots by making a feedback loop. So, for example, the trace of the identity resolves itself into a number of scalars equal to the dimension here, in this case, 3. Now, how does this connect to knots? Well, the key way of seeing this is through this idea of the bracket polynomial. So we have some knot diagram. So we look at the sort of crossings in the knot diagram. If we focus on one of them, we sort of put a lens over one of them, we see this overcrossing here, then we can resolve it into the two ways of smoothing it out into a planar diagram, either sort of cutting it up here and here to make a facing cup and cap, or smoothing it the other way, and then we get essentially an identity element here. And so the idea is that each overcrossing in a knot or link is evaluated to a weighted sum of the two possible planar smoothings in the Temperley-Lieb algebra. And this is what gives, if we follow this through all the way, we eventually get a value in the Temperley-Lieb algebra, and eventually a scalar value, which is the knot polynomial. So this plays a central role in that development. Okay, so that was one excursion into topology. But now let's come back to computation, and in fact to the lambda calculus. What I want to show is that if we take a linear form of the lambda calculus, where we don't copy things, we treat resources in a linear or resource-sensitive fashion, then the very same structure is apparent there, where it may have seemed quite different. So this is one of the standard combinators, where forms of functional composition that we have in the lambda calculus. It's the so-called bracketing combinator, which corresponds to essentially function composition. If you think about this, where you understand multiplication here as function application, it's just the most general way you could possibly write the operation of taking two functions and forming their composition, where the z now is just an argument that expresses how the composed functions are applied. And of course, it has this defining equation. Now, this notice, by the way, is a sort of typed version of the calculus, where we try and express the functional behavior that the various expressions have. These kind of ideas of the variables and the linkages, that the variables that are sort of available for use in the expression, which are sort of traditionally expressed in this context here. So we sort of, in a careful description of the syntax, you have to say what your identifiers are. You have to list them and actually give some types for them, maybe, just as you would do in a subroutine in a modern programming language. So the fact that something occurring in this expression here is connected up with this thing in the environment is just expressed graphically in terms of one of these caps. And the fact that in the end, this variable is going to be applied to the output of that. So what we're doing here, in fact, is for the things that behave like functions, the x and the y, we have, so to speak, two ports. One is where you plug in the input, and the other is where you get the output. So x minus here is where you plug in the input to x, and x plus is where you get the output. Now, since x is applied to this expression, here we're expressing by this cup that the input of x is connected to the output of y. And similarly, y is applied to z, so we're expressing here that the input of y is connected to z. I mean, z has no internal structure in this expression. And finally, the value of the whole expression is the output of x. So we get this diagram for this expression in these three variables. When we abstract the variables, we close up the expression, we shift everything over, and we get this thing here. And now the computational process, the beta reduction, the dynamics of lambda calculus that we saw earlier, itself gets expressed as diagrammatic simplification. If I connect up this expression to a list of arguments here, then simplifying this expression in the same way we've already seen, tracing out the paths, the information flow paths in this diagram, what I end up with is this daisy chain, which expresses that B is applied to C, its output is fed into A, and A's output is the output of the whole expression. So this diagram does or expresses the effect of beta reduction of functional computation here. And we focused on these planar examples because of the link with topology, but of course in computation in general, there is no restriction to planarity, and we get strictly more functions if we allow non-planar things. Corresponds to going from a monoidal category to a symmetric monoidal category. So for example, here is the C combinator, which exchanges the order of its arguments. So we get some non-planar crossing. And otherwise, we get a very similar kind of diagram that shows the functional behavior of this combinator. OK, so let me finish with one further example, some recent work from people in our group working with computational linguists, which shows a surprising connection between these kind of structures and things that happen in natural language and computational linguistics, an area that one might have thought would be of a completely different nature. And what is interesting about this work is that it brings together two very different looking formalisms, a grammatical formalism, due to Jim Lambeck, one of the pioneers of category theory and categorical logic, but also somebody who's made important contributions to formal grammars in linguistics. And the latest version of his grammars, the so-called pre-group grammars, I'm just going to show here a sort of grammatical analysis of one of his grammars, and you can see that it's a very similar structure to what we've been talking about. The idea in this case is that different grammatical categories, different grammatical types, are represented in terms of their quasi-functional behavior, where we think of the behavior of a part of speech, a noun or a verb or something like that, in terms of what you can put alongside it in order to get to produce something of yet another type. So the what this is saying is we can put a pronoun to the right of this and form, and then put a comparative to the right of that, and so on, such that we use up these argument types, and what is left is the overall type of this expression. So in this case, the cups and the caps are expressing a kind of evaluation which directly follows the syntactic structure of the sentence. It's a very geometrical idea, a functional application, where it really is a concatenation of texts, which is the notion that's being described. But really, it's just another version of the description of functional behavior that we saw much earlier when we were discussing the lambda calculus. So this is the first level of description. And you can see that it has the same kind of structure with cups and caps and so on, and diagrammatic simplification that we have been discussing. The second one is something that looks completely different. It's a vector space model that's been widely used in information retrieval and data mining for quite a few decades. It's a so-called distributional model. So quite likely that many of the searches that you do have used some of this technology. The idea is that words are interpreted in a high-dimensional vector space. So you have some basis of standard reference words, and then what's done is to scan the huge corpuses of text that are now available and make counts of frequencies of co-occurrences of words within a small radius of the word you're interested in. So in other words, you know a word by the company it keeps is the usual motto. So if you get high frequency account of certain reference words, then that's telling you useful information about a given word, and that's the representation that's used. So on the word level, this is widely used and rather successful. The striking thing here is that by recognizing this structure, we can actually lift this word level of meaning to something that operates on the level of phrases and whole sentences. And the key is to see that this very same structure, cups and caps and all the rest of it, that lives in this Lambeck grammars, rather like a sort of non-commutative lambda calculus, in fact, is the same common structure that we find in the vector space model of meaning. And of course, we know that it lives there in the vector space model of meaning because it's essentially the same thing we saw in the quantum realm. We're just thinking of these as real Hilbert spaces in this case. So we have the same, because of entanglement, map state duality, and the things that we saw earlier, we see the very same structures living in the vector space models, and hence we can map homomorphically or functorially the syntactic analysis by Lambeck pregroups into the vector space model that's used at the word level. And that allows meaning to be lifted to larger units. So potentially this is a very exciting development. And there's current work going on by Manoush Sadrazadeh and one of the students, Ed Greffenstetter, which is really doing implementations and benchmarks. It looks very promising. In fact, it seems that analogs, I mean, not of course coming from a physical theory, but analogs of entanglement, non-local correlations can occur in many different situations that they have nothing to do with quantum mechanics. That seems to be some of the flavor of what's going on here, because of course, you see that in the syntactic model, we're already seeing how things that are far away in a text may still be related and have some kind of mutual effect. Okay, so I'll end my sort of tour here. The sort of general thing I've tried to convey is that there's a common core of structure, structures in monoidal categories, things like compact structure, traces, and so on, with the associated graphical or diagrammatic calculus. And that really seems to provide a canonical setting for discussing processes in a sort of resource-sensitive or linear setting. And they've been used quite extensively in that way, either implicitly or explicitly in computer science. And what we've seen recently is that they're highly relevant to work in quantum information and quantum foundations. And incidentally, there's quite active connections with some of the work going on at PI. I believe Lucien has declared himself to be a fully paid-up member of the picturalist revolution, and Rob Speckens has also been involved in some work in this connection. And as we've seen in this rather sort of hectic tour, the same structures reach into a wide range of other disciplines. And I could have talked about logic in the same terms, simplification of proofs, and we see the same structures appearing there. So I think this is one promising ingredient for the kind of general theory of information flow, which we sort of began off by saying, well, it would be a nice thing to have, and something we're quite far from having at the moment. I think there are other promising ingredients. A personal enthusiasm of mine is the use of sheaves and similar structures as a general logic of contextuality, which does seem to work very well as a way of giving a unified description of non-locality and contextuality in quantum mechanics. And that was what my talk in the Quantum Foundation seminar yesterday was about. So I think these pieces hopefully can be put together in a nice fashion. There are already some ideas about that. And they will give, I think, two important building blocks for the kind of unified theory that we're seeking. So at any rate, let me express my personal enthusiasm that I think the interface between physics and computer science is currently vibrant and fruitful. I think there can be a lot of ideas passing in both directions along this interface, and I look forward to this continuing. So thanks very much.
Yes, I have a question about this flow diagram of information you showed at some where you had this path. And so it was corresponding to some, you had sets of quantum processes between the third pieces of your systems, and you were studying the flow information like that. And with your rules, you had a unique path which goes from the input to the output. I'm wondering if you have many, many subparts of systems and many different combinations of operations, is it obvious that you always have a unique path, or can you get stuck at some point, or can you have...
Yes, I mean, it was connected in a favorable fashion to get this particularly elegant answer.
Yes.
What is true is that you can use these kind of methods for a wide range of situations. I mean, I can only hint at that here, but has been applied to a lot of things, quantum key distribution, by a lot of protocols, measurement-based quantum computation, and so on. And also, I mean, implicitly here, I was looking at pure states, but the whole thing carries over in a very nice fashion to mixed states and completely positive maps. There's a sort of general construction at the categorical level that describes that. And there are very nice structures you can build on top of these monoidal categories Frobenius algebras and so on that give a very nice handle on the way that measurement operators of various kinds work, and so on. So the expressive power is quite considerable. Obviously, I was showing a particularly nice and clean example. But I mean, one nice application of this kind of structure was indeed to show a result about measurement-based quantum computing, a sort of a result. improvement on previous results showing general conditions for a deterministic flow in a measurement-based quantum computing system. So that would be an example of a fairly general result in that direction. But of course, you know, one has to have some assumptions to get results.
Yes, I'm not sure this is a fair question, actually, but you started off making some fairly general points about Shannon.
Yes.
And
I think the only point I said was that it wasn't, it shouldn't close the discussion.
Exactly.
So.
No, exactly. So I was just wondering if you've got some morals to draw from the particular discussion you've given about how that bears on the sort of general issues that you've sort of. How you characterize information in general, how you might go beyond. But you may not actually have
Well, I think my picture is that the sort of hope is to sort of build upwards and outwards to get a more comprehensive theory than we currently have. And in particular, I think because, you know, as my little story was illustrating, you can get these different assumptions coming from different disciplines, and then people speak at cross purposes. So I think things that work in different settings, even with, you know, different subject matter, I think is a hopeful sign that you're on the right lines of something robust and general. So here I'm certainly in all of this focusing on this kind of information flow and process aspect. So I don't say that that's the whole story. And incidentally, one of the major points would be to achieve a full rapprochement of this kind of thing with information theory in the standard sense. So I would certainly want to see that.
I want to come back to your question about whether information can increase.
Yes.
Because it seems to me that in the real world, information does increase by the emergence of structures and of a kind which are well, the word emergence means cannot be described in terms of the language of description of a lower level. So you may have a general theory of information, but, you know, say when one gets, you know, biological cells, there is a coding of information which is not explicable in the language of the positions of the quantum states of the elementary particles that contain them. And
yes, there's a long-standing debate about reductionism and non-reductionism. And
I think the debate is done. But anyway, let me presume the debate is done and. There is not a meaningful quote reduction of the information in the biological system to information about positions and momenta of the elementary particles that are in those biological molecules. I think that when biology comes to exist, there is an increase in information in the world, but is that an increase in information of a kind that methodologies like yours can illuminate or?
I've got no problem with that sort of general point. It's just that I think that we should then try and understand what's going on in this emergence phenomenon itself, rather than sort of seeing it as something inaccessible understanding. And it has been suggested that one of the things that's happening is exactly this kind of reflexive behavior. So the idea by sort of line of work of associated with people like Robert Rosen and so on in biology. That, I mean, I'm not sort of giving an opinion about it, but it's particularly plausible when you come to the sort of higher level things like cognition and language and so on. That reflexivity, self-reference, recursion are deeply implicated in those processes. Which is why I did want to mention the things I began with, where we've understood in a set quite a lot and developed some tools in the computer science setting, which I think may be useful in understanding some of these very interesting phenomena. But
okay,
how it all joins up,
I
don't think anyone knows at present. So that's why I'm saying that my picture is we sort of spread things outwards and hopefully they join up at some point.
But to put it in a sentence, biology or a biological structure containing new forms of information may be something like fixed points that recursion goes to in a more general setting.
It could be, yes. I mean, and the, yeah, I mean, so we can, Yes, I mean, there's also the idea of diagonalizing out of something that you had before, which is another appealing sort of idea of how you might sort of jump up from one level of... I mean, but this is sort of... At the moment, I would say these kinds of... this kind of is some speculation. So one would like to get something that's clearer and more precise and more specific that may give a basis for saying something more definite.
I would just like to ask for clarification because I'm not sure. You did draw a connection between this linear diagrammatic way of looking at things and the lambda calculus.
Yes.
But that, as I understood it, that does not include these recursive and self-referencing features of the lambda calculus.
Yeah, I mean, you can understand it in a very concrete way. I mean, one can speak, in fact, of the linear lambda calculus, which is a constrained version of the calculus, where if you have a variable, you can use it, but you can only use it once. It's like a sort of token that you consume when you use it. And in the Y combinator, the fact that you made two copies of the argument is absolutely essential. And incidentally, if you analyze the structure of the diagonal arguments, as in the Gödel theorem and so on, it's been done in a very beautiful way in a famous paper by Lovere, for example, then you see that absolutely central in that is the humble diagonal function. The diagonal argument is ultimately about the fact that you have the diagonal function. The diagonal function is just the stupid function from x to x cross x that takes an input and gives you two copies of the input. That's the essential step in diagonalization. If you don't have that, what happens to your ability to create these diagonal arguments? So there's that sort of gap between the two things. And the same thing plays out in terms of complexity. As I mentioned, the full lambda calculus is a computationally universal formalism. If I take away the ability to copy variables, everything normalizes in linear time. So there's this huge gap. Now you can put in constrained forms of copying and actually recover various complexity classes in that way. In the context of quantum mechanics, we can't clone things, but these Frobenius algebras and similar structures let you do actually, the fact that you can copy relative to a basis, I mean, if you're on the basis, you can copy, actually gives you a way of defining what a basis is in these kind of diagrammatic terms. So that boundary between the linear and quantum world on the one hand, is I think there's a lot to be understood there. And these are some pieces of that.
I think we've got stop here, but the reception is around till Friday, inclusive Saturday, and you're in office 221.
221.
And very happy to talk.
Very happy indeed, yes. So if there's anything you didn't understand or want to beat me up about, then please.
Also, remind you there will be some snacks downstairs. But let's thank Samson once again.